Hello, everyone. I am Doug Black. Welcome to my presentation on more toxicities and pharmacologic issues that you should know. Today we have 11 to discuss. I am also an editor for the Sanford Guide. Our general format today will be to present a case vignette for each issue, ask a question and answer it, and then spend a few minutes elaborating. Hopefully, you will find the explanations and the reinforcement to be helpful as you prepare for your exam. So here's our first case. A 22-year-old woman presents with acute onset chest pain and painful swallowing that started 2 days ago. She has no history of reflux or GERD, no fever, cough, or shortness of breath. On upper GI endoscopy, we see linear ulcerations in her mid-esophagus, mucosal erythema, and superficial erosions. She recently began a new antibacterial medication for acne a few days ago, and the suspicion here is drug-induced or pill esophagitis. Antibiotics account for about 50% of the cases of pill esophagitis. So here's our first question. Based on the case, which antibacterial do you suspect she was taking? A. Levofloxacin, B. Cefalexin, C. Linezolid, D. Metronidazole, or E. Doxycycline? The answer is E. Doxycycline. I am not aware of credible reports linking any of the other antibiotics with pill esophagitis. Tetracyclines like doxycycline are famous for pill esophagitis, in part because they are acidic in solution. This is particularly true of the hyclate formulation versus the monohydrate formulation, and is one reason why the monohydrate formulation is generally preferred. So this is an overview of pill esophagitis. It is characterized by sudden onset odontophagia, retrosternal chest pain and dysphagia, appearing hours, sometimes days, after drug ingestion. Important risk factors include the supine position after drug ingestion, not taking the pills with enough water, a pre-existing motility disorder, older age, or taking large or multiple medications. Management includes discontinuing the offending agent, good hydration, and a soft diet, and supportive treatments such as sucralfate, proton pump inhibitors, or viscous lidocaine could be considered. Endoscopy can be considered if symptoms are severe, there is no improvement in 3 to 5 days, or if there is concern for complications. The symptoms of pill esophagitis typically resolve in a few days to maybe a week. If you are presented on your exam with a case that sounds like pill esophagitis, here are the main drugs that you should be looking for: azithromycin, clindamycin, penicillins, which are rare, rifampin, tetracyclines, the most common, and TMPSMX. These drugs are listed in alphabetical order, not order of likelihood. Now, there are some non-antibiotic drugs worth remembering, including NSAIDs, bisphosphonates for osteoporosis, such as Fosamax, which is alendronate, iron tablets, and slow-release potassium products. When we counsel patients taking doxycycline, we don't want them to take the evening dose with minimal fluids, then immediately lay down. We instruct patients to take the pill with at least 8 ounces of water and then remain upright for at least 30 minutes after ingestion. Let's move on to our next vignette. This is a 76-year-old woman who presents with acute confusion, hallucinations, and tremors that began 2 days ago. Her past medical history includes hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and chronic kidney disease with a creatinine clearance of around 40. Home meds include hydrochlorothiazide and a few other things. Her head CT has no acute abnormalities. There is no pleocytosis on LP, and her glucose and protein are within normal limits. 4 days ago, she began valacyclovir 1 gram Q8 hours for shingles. Now notice that the valacyclovir dose of 1 gram Q8 hours is too high for her renal function. At her creatinine clearance of around 40 mils per minute, the proper dose is 1 gram Q12 hours. Remember too that valacyclovir, which is a prodrug, is simply the L-valine ester of acyclovir. So what this case really is a case of acyclovir neurologic toxicity. Which of the following is a risk factor for valacyclovir neurotoxicity in this patient? A, renal impairment. B, treatment with hydrochlorothiazide. C, hyperlipidemia, D, hypertension, or E, active varicella zoster virus infection? The answer is A, renal impairment. None of the others are known risk factors for valacyclovir neurotoxicity. I think things are pretty clear here. The renal impairment in this patient, coupled with an inappropriately high valacyclovir dose, resulted in toxic acyclovir concentrations. And here is what we know about acyclovir, including valacyclovir, neurologic toxicity. Early presenting signs and symptoms include agitation, hallucinations, confusion, or disorientation. Later on, we see tremor, myoclonus, or delirium, and we may even see seizures. I should add that the onset is often within a couple of days of starting therapy. Risk factors for this include renal impairment, older age, high doses, and dehydration. In her case, the thiazide diuretic probably contributed or may have contributed a bit of dehydration and may have increased the likelihood of toxicity. The pathophysiology of acyclovir neurologic toxicity is thought to be due to accumulation of a metabolite known as CMMG, which stands for 9-carboxymethoxymethylguanine. Now, most of acyclovir is eliminated unchanged in the urine. However, a little bit is metabolized to CMMG, which has a long half-life that can accumulate in renal insufficiency to toxic levels. And older people are particularly susceptible to its neurotoxic effects. The management of acyclovir neurologic toxicity includes stopping the drug, making dosage adjustments if necessary, hydrating the patient if necessary, and in extreme cases, hemodialysis could even be considered. If you are presented on your exam with a case of potential drug-induced neurotoxicity that has features such as delirium, neuropathy, or seizures, here are some of the drugs that you should look for. Beta-lactams, ethambutol, fluoroquinolones, isoniazid, linezolid, metronidazole, and nitrofurantoin. Now, with beta-lactams, I'd add a few comments. With the encephalopathy, I'm mainly referring here to cefepime and piperacillin-tazobactam. Seizures are particularly associated with carbapenems, although they're probably not an issue if the drug is properly dosed. Imipenem has a reputation, at least, for being the most proconvulsant. To isoniazid, I would add the comment that you can usually prevent the neurotoxicity by administering pyridoxine or vitamin B6 on a daily basis. And the neurotoxicity we associate with nitrofurantoin is typically in patients taking it chronically and patients of older age. So let's move on to our third case. This is a 52-year-old man presenting to the ED with an itchy rash, angioedema, and fever that started a day ago. He began a six-week course of vancomycin 4 weeks ago after surgical debridement for right fifth digit osteomyelitis. A day after his presentation, the rash has now spread to his palms and soles, and there is concern for impending airway compromise due to facial swelling, so he is admitted to the ICU. He has important laboratory findings, eosinophils of 2025 per microliter, elevated IgE, atypical lymphocytes, plus evidence of acute kidney injury. His AST and ALT are within normal limits. Blood cultures, ANA, HIV, HSV serologies are negative. His skin biopsy shows spongiotic dermatitis with perivascular eosinophils. This is diagnosed as a case of DRESS, a severe cutaneous adverse reaction with a U.S.-specific mortality rate of about 5%. DRESS accounts for about 23% of cutaneous drug interruptions in hospitalized patients. So let me ask a question. What is the antimicrobial agent most commonly associated with DRESS in the United States? TMPSMX, minocycline, fluconazole, azithromycin, or vancomycin? The answer is E, vancomycin. Among all drugs accounting for DRESS in the United States, vancomycin is actually number two behind allopurinol, which is number one. Response A, TMPSMX, is number five among all drugs in the U.S. And just to complete the U.S. list, we would have lamotrigine as number three and carbamazepine as number four. Response B, minocycline, is also known to cause DRESS. Response C and D, fluconazole and azithromycin, respectively, are also known perpetrators, albeit rare. So this is a quick summary of DRESS. A T-cell-mediated severe cutaneous adverse reaction, most commonly associated with anti-seizure medications, antibiotics, allopurinol, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. It has a latency of 2 to 6 weeks. It presents with rash, fever, facial edema, lymphadenopathy, eosinophils above 700 per microliter, atypical lymphocytosis, and internal organ involvement. There is a validated European scoring system called Registar that can be helpful. The management of DRESS includes just stopping the drug, supportive care, and then administration of corticosteroids. So on your exam, be thinking about DRESS in a patient with a diffuse morbilliform rash covering more than 50% of the total body surface, especially if it occurs 2 to 6 weeks after starting an offending antimicrobial. And here's a more complete list of antimicrobial drug causes: vancomycin, TMPSMX, beta-lactams, tetracyclines, clindamycin, nitrofurantoin, all of the four first-line antituberculous agents, nevirapine, an antiretroviral, and dapsone. Our fourth vignette is an osteomyelitis case. This is a 62-year-old man presenting with a three-week history of worsening pain, swelling, and foul-smelling discharge from an ulcer on his left foot. He's been treated twice with oral antibiotics in the past without improvement. He has recently developed low-grade fevers and difficulty walking. He has a history of diabetes, hypertension, and peripheral neuropathy. What adverse effect of metronidazole is of most concern in this patient? A, nausea. B, leukopenia. C, disulfiram reaction. D, metallic taste. Or E, peripheral neuropathy. So the answer is E, peripheral neuropathy. Nausea, response A, and metallic taste, response D, are both common and manageable. The mechanism of the metallic taste is not precisely known. It can help patients if they suck on hard candies or chew sugar-free gum during treatment, the idea here being to increase saliva production and wash away the foul taste. Response B, leukopenia, if it occurs, tends to be mild and reversible. And the disulfiram reaction, response C, probably isn't a real thing with metronidazole, and we have a specific vignette about it later on. So here's what we know about metronidazole-induced peripheral neuropathy: burning and tingling and numbness in a stocking glove pattern. Risk factors include prolonged therapy, so more than 2 to 4 weeks, a high total dose, a pre-existing neuropathy of some type, such as from diabetes, the use of other neurotoxic drugs. We often identify VICA alkaloids such as vincristine as an example here. The management of metronidazole-induced peripheral neuropathy includes stopping the drug, administration of neuropathic pain meds, and maybe PTOT. As with other drugs that cause peripheral neuropathy, recovery is typically slow, can be weeks to months. Metronidazole-induced neuropathy is often reversible if recognized early, but prolonged, unrecognized exposure may mean incomplete recovery. I would add two stewardship points to this. One, I think if a long drug course is being planned for a patient, it's useful to counsel that patient on early symptoms that he or she can watch for. And two, just periodically reassessing someone's need for metronidazole is a good idea. Case vignette 5 is a purulent skin infection case. It's a 65-year-old man who's being treated for a forearm infection that has developed purulent drainage over the past few days. His past medical history includes a MRSA infection last year. Vital signs, temperature 38, other vital signs within normal limits, white count 14.8. His serum creatinine is 1.3, which gives him an estimated creatinine clearance of around 60 mils per minute. Home meds include valsartan and chlorthalidone, an old-time thiazide-type diuretic. The decision is made to incise and drain the wound and then begin TMPSMX, two double-strength tablets, every 12 hours until he is afebrile for 3 to 5 days. On the third day of treatment, his white blood cell count and all his vital signs are within normal limits, but his serum creatinine has increased from 1.3 to 1.6. Now, just to be clear on the dosing here, for this infection, a reasonable dose is 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram per day of the trimethoprim component of TMPSMX. He is being administered 2 double strength every 12 hours. That means a total dose of 640 milligrams of trimethoprim, which means he is getting about 9 milligrams per kilogram per day of TMP divided every 12 hours. We do not reduce the dose of TMPSMX until the creatinine clearance is below 30, and he is at 60, at 1.3. Even at 1.6, he is still above 30. What would be the most reasonable course of action here? A, to continue TMPSMX at the same dose. B, to continue TMPSMX at a reduced dose. C, discontinue TMPSMX. D, change to intravenous vancomycin, standard dosing. Or E, change to oral dicloxacillin at typical dosing, 500 milligrams orally every 6 hours. The best answer is A, to continue the TMPSMX as is. His creatinine clearance is still above the cut point for reducing the dose, as we mentioned, so B really isn't the correct answer. Discontinuing the TMPSMX, option C, isn't right because he's only had a few days of therapy. Option D, changing to IV vancomycin, would probably work, but it also means the hassle of IV therapy and therapeutic drug monitoring, and we can avoid all that. And E, changing to dicloxacillin isn't right because the purulence he is exhibiting suggests MRSA, plus he has a history of MRSA infection. But what do we make of this bump in serum creatinine from 1.3 to 1.6 milligram per deciliter, and is it likely to get worse if we continue the therapy? So what's probably going on here is the phenomenon of TMPSMX-induced increased serum creatinine, a little bump in serum creatinine, without affecting the glomerular filtration rate. Increased serum creatinine without affecting GFR. This phenomenon is thought to be due to the fact that trimethoprim can compete with creatinine for tubular secretion. What we typically see here is an increase in serum creatinine of around 20%. It's dose dependent, which means you suspect it most dramatically at the doses we use for something like, say, pneumocystis, pneumonia. It is not expected to get progressively worse with therapy. This little bump in serum creatinine can be confusing since the drug TMPSMX is also actually associated with renal impairment via a number of different mechanisms, including acute interstitial nephritis, crystalluria, and rarely acute tubular necrosis. By the way, other drugs that can do this, bump the creatinine without changing the filtration rate, include bictegravir and cobicistat, so those are worth remembering. It's also worth remembering as an additional pearl that TMPSMX can result in hyperkalemia. That's due to the fact that TMP acts like amiloride, which is a can act like amiloride in the kidney, which is a potassium-sparing diuretic. We more commonly see this phenomenon at higher doses. This graphic is intended to show how TMP, trimethoprim, is thought to increase the serum creatinine. You can ignore the VAN, that's vancomycin. You can ignore TZP. In the center of the diagram is a proximal tubular cell. And in blue are renal transporters. There are up to 6 of them. Up to 6 renal transporters help to carry creatinine from the blood into the urine during the process of tubular secretion. And the mechanism here is TMP is thought to compete with creatinine for up to 4 of those transporters, as you can see in the graphic, thus reducing the urinary secretion of creatinine and boosting its concentrations without affecting the GFR. Here's our 6th case. This is a 71-year-old man who presents to the ED complaining of jaundice for 2 weeks associated with itching and a mild rash. He also mentions his urine is dark brown. He has no fever, headache, myalgias, arthralgias, no respiratory symptoms, abdominal pain, no nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, no anorexia, no weight loss. He has no known exposure to alcohol or illicit drugs, no known drug allergies, he's a non-smoker, nothing relevant on abdominal imaging. Lab values include hyperbilirubinemia with an elevated alkaline phosphatase, and his AST and ALT are mildly elevated. 2 days ago, he finished a 14-day course of an antibiotic for a respiratory tract infection. So this sounds like a case of cholestatic jaundice, possibly drug-induced. Here's the question. Which of the following oral antibiotics that he might have taken is most associated with drug-induced liver disease? A, moxifloxacin, B, azithromycin, C, cefuroxime acetyl, D, doxycycline, or E, amoxicillin clavulanate. The answer is E, amoxicillin clavulanate, or Augmentin. Liver disease is probably not the first thing that comes to our mind when we think of amoxicillin clavulanate. More commonly, we think of diarrhea or rash. As for the other responses, we don't typically associate moxifloxacin A, cefuroxime response C, or doxycycline response D with drug-induced liver disease. Azithromycin response B is a possibility, but it typically wouldn't be used for 14 days, and it's also not as commonly associated with drug-induced liver disease as amoxicillin clavulanate. So here are the details. Amoxicillin clavulanate-induced liver disease, one of the most common causes of drug-induced liver disease, more common than amoxicillin alone. Typically shows up late, maybe 3 weeks after the start of therapy. Risk factors include male sex, age greater than 55, consumption of ethanol, repeated use of the drug, suggesting some sort of immunoallergic mechanism, and concomitant use of other hepatotoxic drugs. Typical clinical features: fatigue, fever, nausea, abdominal pain, pruritus, jaundice. The most common pattern of LFT abnormalities is a cholestatic picture. A mixed or hepatocellular pattern may be seen in younger patients. Amoxicillin clavulanate-induced liver disease is usually reversible, but it's slow. It might take up to 6 months. And if you are presented with a case of what might be drug-induced liver disease on your exam, here are some of the other drugs you should look for. The antimicrobacterials are well known for this: INH, PZA, rifampin, bedaquiline, macrolides, especially erythromycin, minocycline, which is associated with an autoimmune hepatitis, oxacillin, terbinafine, an antifungal, TMPSMX, the azole antifungals, fluconazole, voriconazole, etc., and then an antiretroviral, nevirapine. Here's case 7. We're dealing with a 65-year-old mildly obese man who is a renal transplant recipient. His anti-rejection regimen includes prednisone. He has an active lifestyle. His estimated creatinine clearance is around 45, and he is prescribed 14 days of levofloxacin, 750 milligrams a day, for prostatitis. After 10 days of taking levofloxacin, he complains of bilateral Achilles tendon, or AT, pain. He says it began around 3 to 4 days after starting levofloxacin. He has switched to TMPSMX to finish up his therapy. His AT is still painful 4 days later, so they increase his prednisone dose. And then 1 month later, after all this, he loses his footing and slips, and he ruptures his left Achilles tendon. A few comments here. First of all, his creatinine clearance is 45. At a creatinine clearance of 45, the dose of levofloxacin that he was prescribed should have been given Q48 hours, not Q24 hours. So he got too much. This case was a case I was consulted on, and it was never really fully clear to me why the prednisone was increased. From the various chart notes, it appeared to be to possibly help with the tendon pain. And this case took place kind of before there was widespread appreciation by all of us of fluoroquinolone-induced musculoskeletal toxicity. So here's our question. Which fluoroquinolone is most associated with Achilles tendon rupture? A, gemifloxacin, B, ciprofloxacin, C, levofloxacin, D, moxifloxacin, or E, deflofloxacin? Response C, levofloxacin, is the answer most supported by the published literature. Now, this can be a difficult question to answer, in part because the fluoroquinolones have not been around for the same length of time. For example, ciprofloxacin had a 10-year head start on levofloxacin. Ciprofloxacin was approved in 1987, and levofloxacin didn't come along until 1996. So here's what we know about fluoroquinolones and tendon toxicity. These drugs can cause inflammation or rupture of tendons, particularly the Achilles tendon, often bilaterally. Tendinopathy occurs at an incidence of up to 0.4%. Actual rupture is rare, maybe one or two cases per 10,000 patients. Often you see tendonitis before rupture, but not always. Onset can be days to weeks, but it may be delayed, as it was in this patient. The symptoms include of tendinopathy or tendon toxicity include tenderness, pain, swelling, stiffness, maybe sharp pain with walking, and the symptoms tend to occur acutely. Statins do not seem to increase the risk, and the mechanism of tendon toxicity due to fluoroquinolones is unclear, but there are theories. Fluoroquinolones may cause direct tissue damage. They may also indirectly induce toxicity by stimulating local release of tissue-damaging substances such as nitric oxide or free radicals, or by stimulating enzymes that degrade collagen. Fluoroquinolones are also known chelators, so they may also deplete divalent cations like magnesium that are essential for maintenance of tendon health. So there's a number of theories. Focusing here on the first column on the slide, these are the accepted risk factors for fluoroquinolone tendon rupture based on published literature, and I'll read them. Age greater than 60, concomitant steroid use, which I put in bold because it's so important, male gender, obesity, and cumulative days of fluoroquinolone exposure. There may be other risk factors, but I am unwilling to commit to them because the published reports are a little bit contradictory. There are also risk factors associated with tendinopathy in general, such as rheumatologic disease or diabetes. And this topic is so important that it deserves a slide devoted only to the management. So the first sign of tendon pain, swelling, or inflammation, patients should stop taking the fluoroquinolone, avoid using the affected area, and seek evaluation, and perhaps transition to a non-fluoroquinolone drug. Non-surgical strategies for management include analgesics, physical therapy, maybe immobilization. In severe cases, surgery may be required. Most patients recover within a month without debilitating consequences, but in some cases, it can take longer than that, up to 6 months, or maybe even longer than that. Swelling, pain, difficulty walking may occasionally become long-term complications. Case number 8 is a predictable toxicity from linezolid. We're dealing with a 68-year-old man who complains of fatigue, easy bruising, and gum bleeding. His past medical history includes obesity, diabetes, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, and chronic osteomyelitis of his right foot. His right foot underwent surgical debridement about 3 weeks ago, at which time he was started on linezolid, 600 milligrams every 12 hours. So he's had 3 weeks of that. His serum creatinine is 1.6 milligram per deciliter, which puts his estimated creatinine clearance at around 55 mils per minute. His vital signs are within normal limits. His hemoglobin is 9.1, hematocrit 27, white blood cell count 2,100 per microliter, platelets 62,000 per microliter, low reticulocytes. His B12 and folate are within normal limits. So in summary, he has been taking a linezolid for 3 weeks. He is now anemic, leukopenic, and thrombocytopenic. So what is the most important risk factor for linezolid myelosuppression in this patient? A, renal impairment. B, treatment duration greater than 2 weeks. C, obesity. D, treatment with lisinopril. Or E, diabetes. I mean, it really comes down to renal impairment or prolonged treatment duration, because obesity, ACE inhibitors, and diabetes, responsive C3, are not recognized risk factors for linezolid myelosuppression. The answer is B, treatment duration greater than 2 weeks, as the best answer. Renal impairment is second best. It's a contributor. Although linezolid is not extensively cleared by the kidneys, its metabolites can accumulate in renal dysfunction, potentially contributing to toxicity. Now, that actually might be negated in him, because he's obese, and he might actually be underdosed to 600 milligrams every 12 hours. So in this case, any impact of renal impairment is probably somewhat blunted. Here are the key details of linezolid-induced myelosuppression. So it is a reversible pancytopenia. Patients at risk include patients treated for greater than 14 days, kind of an important number, older age, renal dysfunction, as we've mentioned, and the concomitant use of other myelotoxic drugs. The standard monitoring recommendation for linezolid is, if you're pondering prolonged therapy, to obtain a weekly CBC with differential. The management of linazolid-induced myelosuppression includes to stop the drug, switch to something else, monitor the CBC from there on, and if the counts continue to go down or they don't recover, maybe consider a hematology consult. We do expect recovery within 1 to 2 weeks. One final point I would make about this, a toxicity as serious as pancytopenia will often bury a drug, like it did chloramphenicol, at least in the United States. But the difference is with linazolid, the myelosuppression is predictable and reversible. We can work with that. Neither of those things is true with chloramphenicol. With chloramphenicol, the myelosuppression is idiosyncratic, and it tends to be irreversible. We cannot work with those. And if you are presented with a case of unexplained pancytopenia on your exam, here are some of the other adenoid microbials you should be looking for. Beta-lactams, such as nafcillin or piperacillin tazobactam. Chloramphenicol, of course, we've mentioned that. An antifungal flucytosine, which is a drug which is metabolized to 5-fluorouracil when it is ingested, and known myelosuppressing agent. A couple of antiviral drugs, ganciclovir, valganciclovir, pyrimethamine, TMPSMX, and an antiretroviral, zidovudine, which doesn't get used that much anymore. Here's case 9, a 63-year-old man who was admitted with worsening back pain. Note he has an allergy to ceftriaxone. Past medical history includes diabetes. He is bacteremic, and on admission, his blood cultures are growing Enterococcus faecalis, pan-sensitive. His estimated creatinine clearance is 1.3, which means he has a creatinine clearance of around 62. Mitral valve vegetation on echocardiogram and vertebral osteomyelitis evidence on MRI. So the proposed therapy here is 6 to 8 weeks of the combination, sort of the old school combination of ampicillin plus gentamicin. Ampicillin 2 grams every 4 hours plus gentamicin 70 milligrams every 8 hours. If it weren't for that allergy, then the ampicillin ceftriaxone combination we're using these days would probably be a more attractive choice. Here is the question. Which of the following is the most important management concern specific to this patient? A, the inability to give ampicillin plus gentamicin to an outpatient. B, drug-induced nephrotoxicity. C, target gentamicin levels not well defined in this setting. D, drug-induced ototoxicity. Or E, the use of ampicillin in somebody with ceftriaxone allergy. Well, first of all, the option A is not right because outpatient therapy is in fact a possibility. It's been published. C isn't right because gentamicin target levels are in fact well-defined in this setting. And option E isn't right because there is not a problem in using ampicillin in somebody with a ceftriaxone allergy, because those two drugs do not share the same R1 side chain. So really the answer in this question comes down to either B or D. And I would argue that while both nephrotoxicity and ototoxicity are concerns because of the gentamicin, ototoxicity is the bigger concern, and therefore the answer is D. And I show you why on this slide. So let's review some relevant features of aminoglycoside ototoxicity, column on the right. Ototoxicity from aminoglycosides can be auditory or vestibular or both. Unlike nephrotoxicity, I should say, it tends to be irreversible. That's an important point. With auditory toxicity, the high frequencies are affected first. Vestibular toxicity can have a devastating impact on someone's quality of life. Patients experience imbalance, unsteadiness, chronic dizziness, oscillopsia. Other features of aminoglycoside ototoxicity include, and they're all on the slide, poorly defined risk factors, poorly defined time course, no easy laboratory markers to follow, and poor correlation between serum drug levels and the phenomenon. And all four of those are kind of the least attractive manifestation compared to the nephrotoxicity version of them. So adding all that up, my argument being that ototoxicity is a bigger deal in general, at least in this patient, than nephrotoxicity. And if you are presented with a case of possible drug-induced ototoxicity on your exam, here are some of the antimicrobials to be looking for. Aminoglycosides, of course, like gentamicin, tobramycin, amikacin. K capreomycin, which sounds like an aminoglycoside, but it's actually a polypeptide anti-tuberculous agent. Macrolides, particularly erythromycin, although it has been described with azithromycin, and then vancomycin. Here's our 10th case. This is a 53-year-old man in the ED having experienced a seizure and loss of consciousness. He has a history of alcohol abuse and seizure disorder. His seizures have been managed. He is treated empirically for meningitis with the appropriate regimen for a 53-year-old man. So ceftriaxone, 2 grams every 12 hours, ampicillin, 2 grams every 4 hours, vancomycin, a gram every 12 hours, and dexamethasone. Turns out his head CT and LP findings are unremarkable. His blood and urine cultures are negative. He does have right lower lobe opacity on chest x-ray. So the diagnosis is sort of morphed from meningitis into pneumonia. So they continue with ceftriaxone. They discontinue the ampicillin and the vancomycin and the dexamethasone, and they add azithromycin at a dose of 500 milligrams every 24 hours. After 7 days of that, he is jaundiced with a total bilirubin of 5.8, up from 2.1, a direct bilirubin of 3.4, up from 0.7, and he has a mild right upper quadrant pain. On right upper quadrant ultrasound, we see biliary sludge and cholelithiasis, no evidence of cholecystitis. It is important to note in this case that he was started on a meningitis-level dose of ceftriaxone, 2 grams every 12 hours, but then he was maintained on that dose even when the diagnosis shifted from meningitis to pneumonia. So instead of being reduced, as it should have been, to 1 or 2 grams every 24 hours. So which drug is the most likely explanation for these observations? In other words, which of these drugs is a known cause of biliary sludging and hyperbilirubinemia? A, azithromycin. B, ceftriaxone. C, vancomycin. D, ampicillin. Or E, dexamethasone. And the answer is B, ceftriaxone. None of the other drugs is associated with biliary sludging. Here's what we know about this phenomenon of ceftriaxone pseudocholelithiasis. It all starts because ceftriaxone is excreted in the bile in enormous concentrations, thousands of micrograms per mil. So these gallstones, which consist of a ceftriaxone calcium complex, often just referred to as sludge, may form typically around a week and a half, day 9 of therapy. Risk factors include high doses, such as the meningitis level dose, treatment for a long period of time, dehydration, parenteral nutrition, and then pre-existing hypercalcemia. Presents with right upper quadrant tenderness and nausea and or nausea. The LFTs typically have a cholestatic pattern. In terms of therapy, stopping the drug is typically all you need to do, and the sludge should resolve maybe within a couple of weeks. It is important to think about this because it would be quite natural to instead suspect C. difficile in a patient receiving broad-spectrum antibiotics who starts to complain of abdominal pain. And here's our last vignette. This vignette concerns a classic interaction that we were probably all taught, which is the putative interaction between ethanol and metronidazole. So a 58-year-old man presents to the ED about 45 minutes after experiencing sudden onset nausea, flushing, palpitations, and vomiting. And these symptoms began 20 minutes after he consumed 2 glasses of red wine. 2 days ago, he was started on metronidazole 500 milligrams every 8 hours for suspected C. difficile colitis, point of the vignette not being whether or not that was a good choice or not. For C. difficile colitis. He has no known drug allergies and he takes no other medications. So which of the following best explains this reaction? A, metronidazole-induced serotonin syndrome. B, type 1 hypersensitivity reaction to metronidazole. C, acetaldehyde accumulation. D, ethanol-induced inhibition of metronidazole metabolism. Or E, the mechanism of this reaction is disputed. The answer is E. The mechanism of this reaction is disputed. Option A, metronidazole-induced serotonin syndrome. Option C, acetaldehyde accumulation, and option D, ethanol-induced inhibition of metronidazole metabolism, do not happen. And B, a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction to metronidazole is very rare. So what is the story here? The classic disulfiram reaction, which consists of symptoms such as sweating, heart palpitations, facial flushing, nausea, vertigo, hypotension, tachycardia, happens when people who are taking the drug disulfiram, which is anabuse, consume ethanol, because disulfiram inhibits liver aldehyde dehydrogenase. You can see this on the slide. The symptoms are caused by elevated acetaldehyde concentrations behind the blockade. So a similar reaction has been observed with those symptoms in the occasional patient on metronidazole who consumes ethanol. But the problem is metronidazole has been shown to not inhibit aldehyde dehydrogenase like disulfiram does, nor boost acetaldehyde concentrations like disulfiram does. So the point is this. This reaction between metronidazole and ethanol, although rare, does occur. It is the mechanism that is in question. The old warnings against simultaneous use of ethanol and metronidazole were based on lab experiments and case histories in which the reactions were just as likely to have been caused by ethanol alone, or maybe they were an adverse effect of metronidazole alone. In the current STI guidelines, CDC is clear. Refraining from ethanol use while taking metronidazole is not necessary. And this concludes my presentation. Thank you so much for listening.